We are starting our summer series, as Fenton's already told us, and we are going to be hearing the voice of Jesus as he writes to seven first century churches, but also as he speaks to us. And I want us to think about this series as something of a progress report. Perhaps some of you have had school reports at the end of this year. Maybe some of you can remember school reports from previous years. I think it's warm enough that I've got to go for this bit of audience interaction. So we'll do a quick hands up here. How many of you have ever had a bad school report? Excellent. If you haven't, have a look around at the hands in the air now and go and ask them about it afterwards. I know from looking back on my own school reports which teachers I had who were simply copy and pasting a generic report in, because I look back and just think all they did was look at the grade that I got and then they've just based it on that. Because I can know which teachers really put the effort in because I read those school reports and it doesn't talk about the grades at all. It talks about a lack of effort, a lack of engagement, sometimes despite the end result. And I think those teachers knew me, okay? They knew exactly what I was like. Well, in the early chapters of Revelation, we see Jesus speaking, reporting back to his church, to a series of churches. And he gives them not in a format which gives a mark out of 10 or an A to F scorecard, but instead he writes them letters. And they are honest and truthful, not generic in any way, written to specific churches at a specific time. And as we get into over the next 7 weeks, those individual places with their unique cultures will hear Jesus, a Jesus who knows them. And he's giving them very honest, sometimes painfully honest, feedback. We'll come back to that at the end of this talk. But I want to just acknowledge that we are going into the book of Revelation. If you have been around church at all, that might provoke a certain response in you. Because the book of Revelation is the very last book in the Bible, and it is probably the most misunderstood, almost certainly the most avoided book in the Bible. Because it is wonderful and fantastical and mysterious and sometimes, to be brutally honest, plain weird to our ears. It's very strange. There are beasts and dragons. There are scrolls and seals and bowls. There are undefined heavenly creatures. There's a mysterious woman. There are plagues. There are angels. There are cities and marriages and cities that are marriage, part of marriages, and people that are also cities. And it's weird. Especially, I think, to us as 21st century people. And it's all about the future. Or is it? We're going to have to put up, I think, with the larger Sunday school behind us. So apologies for any ill-timed cheers mid-sermon. Now, I am not going to try and answer all of your questions right now about the book of Revelation, or even begin to try and get our heads around it to some degree. But I do want to point out a couple of things before we dive in. Revelation, or Revelations, depending on who's doing the Bible reading, is a book written by Jesus for his people to encourage them and to equip them with hope and perseverance so that they will keep going. And so that, in the words of Revelation, they will overcome the circumstances that they are facing. And the message of Revelation boils down simply to this: Jesus wins. So even if you don't know anything else about the book of Revelation, or maybe you know far too much about the Revelation and you've got 1,000 questions, the book of Revelation at its simplest says this: Jesus wins. And as Elliot told those of us yesterday, or at Sam and Amelia's wedding, there's a wonderful happy ending, the book of Revelation tells us, for those who are on the side of Jesus. So yes, Revelation is weird and wonderful. It's an apocalyptic book in style, which means that it uses symbolism and imagery to communicate God's truth. And it tells us about what is to come, what is and what is to still to come. And it is, I think, probably part of the Bible that appeals to some of us more than other bits of the Bible. Maybe if you're a creative visual learner, this is something that maybe just speaks to you in a way that other parts of the Bible you struggle with. And conversely, if you're more of a linear, logical thinker, maybe you find Revelation harder. If you want to match up every word and every symbol and every beast and go, well, tell me what that means, you're going to find it harder. One of the commentators that I've been reading about Revelation gives a list of descriptions of Revelation. I found them helpful. I'm going to put them up on the screen. We're not going to go through them all in any sort of detail, but the book of Revelation, it is a Christ-centered book. It's all about the rule and victory of Jesus. It's an open book. Revelation 22 verse 10 tells us, don't shut the book, open it. This is insightful to us. It's a book that's filled with symbols, or we might say it is Old Testament drenched. Okay, on every page of Revelation, you're going to see things from the Old Testament pulled through. It is a book of prophecy. This is God speaking to his people. It is a book with blessing. We've already read Revelation 1 verse 3 that says it is a blessing for this book even to be read aloud, but even more so to be heard and taken to heart. It is a relevant book. It is all about the times that are here, the times that are at hand. It is a majestic book. You will find the theme of the throne. God sat on his throne, ruling over his world, come up again and again and again. It is a universal book. You will find the nations. Every people from every tribe and tongue and nation, every language, every different type of person you could possibly imagine is included in this great story. And it is a climactic book. It is about the end of this world and the beginning of the next, and moving from one to the other. So hopefully that's whetted your appetite a little bit for the book of Revelation. Introduction over. Let's get into the vision that we read earlier. And there are two main points for us, if you're taking notes, and they're about Jesus. Firstly, this is not a little Jesus. And secondly, not a distant Jesus. So if you look back down in your Bibles to verse 9 of Revelation 1, we read this. I, John, your brother and companion in the suffering and kingdom and patient endurance that are ours in Jesus, was on the island of Patmos because of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. This is John, one of the 12 disciples, brother of James, one of many disciples afflicted with foot in mouth syndrome, saying the wrong thing, getting it wrong, beloved by Jesus, one of his 12 closest followers. And after the resurrection of Jesus and his ascension into heaven, John becomes one of the prominent leaders of the early church. And he tells us that he was on the island of Patmos. That's sort of the East Mediterranean, just off the coast of modern day Turkey. And he tells us that he was there because of the word of the Lord and the testimony of Jesus. What does that mean? Well, I think there's a little clue as well in how he describes himself to those he's writing to. He says, I am a companion in the suffering and kingdom and patient endurance that are ours in Jesus. If we put together those words with the testimony of early Christians whose writings we've still got from the first, second, third century, I think we're to understand that John was exiled because of his faith, because of how he was living for Jesus, and maybe particularly because of his role as a leader in the church. He had been forcibly moved by the ruling authorities of the day to this little island to move him out of the way where he could do less damage. And we're told that he's in the Spirit. And I think we can understand that to mean that he is unusually and supernaturally spoken to by God. This is a vision that God gives him. And it has echoes of the Old Testament visions recorded by Isaiah and Ezekiel and Daniel. Something supernatural was taking place. God was speaking to John. And so we're told on the Lord's Day, which we understand to mean a Sunday, the day that Jesus rose, John suddenly hears a loud voice like a trumpet. And I'm resisting the urge to shout at you, but I want to, because that's what John hears, a loud noise from behind. He's, what is that? And it's as though somebody's saying to him, listen up, pay attention. And then he's given an instruction, write down what you see and send it to these churches, these seven churches, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And he hears this, and then he turns round, and we'll read it again. And sees this vision. From verse 12, I turned round to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And among the lampstands was someone like a son of man, dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet, and with a golden sash around his chest. Their hair on his head was white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp double-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in all of its brilliance. Just close your eyes for a second. And just think, what was the thing that stood out to you in that description? What captures your imagination? I suspect it's different for each one of us. You can open your eyes again. I think this is a little bit like getting one of those toys that does everything. Every year they used to release the list of the most popular Christmas toy, the most sold thing. I think one, when I was young, it was the Thunderbirds, Tracy Island. But those toys that have got moving parts and noises and different add-ons, and there's so many things here, so many features, so many buttons to press. And partly what, as we sit here kind of in John's shoes hearing his description, there is so much to see and to hear. He describes one like the Son of Man. Fenton kind of, took away the surprise element here when he opened our service reading those words from Daniel chapter 7. But maybe that phrase, the Son of Man, rings a bell for you, because you think, hang on, didn't Jesus describe himself like that? The Son of Man, when he was on earth? That phrase means it's somebody who is a man, a human. And it echoes back, if we were steeped in our Old Testament, we would hear that phrase as John used it, and we'd be thinking about those words that Daniel wrote many, many years before. Daniel sees a vision of God's throne room, and he sees a human enter God's throne room on clouds, and the one on the throne, the Ancient of Days, God himself, rewards this man. A man walks into heaven and God says, guys, check this guy out. and he rewards him and acknowledges him, and he gives him the world. Or we could say, God says, this guy is the king. This guy is in charge of everything and every person. All authority is given to him. This man walking amongst the lampstands that John sees is a kingly judge. But that's not all. He's also dressed like a priest. So again, we need to take off our 21st century heads and get ourselves into Old Testament sort of mindset. And when John describes him as wearing this robe and with a sash, if we had our Old Testament heads on, we'd be thinking, hang on, that's what a priest wears. And we could turn back to Exodus and hear the description of what the priest should wear before he goes in to represent the people before God. This man, this heavenly man, is somebody who represents people to God. Now, when we walk down the description, and the description of his hair and his eyes indicating wisdom and insight. And maybe your eyes were drawn to his feet, burning like fire, like bronze, firm and immovable. This is not a guy who is getting knocked off his throne. Maybe it was the voice. He has a voice that is a sound of many waters, like a waterfall. That depth of sounds, that roar, that continuous, dominating, clear sound. There is no mistaking when that voice speaks who's in charge. I think sometimes you can watch sport, even on TV, and you hear a certain player's voice coming over the ref's mic, and you just think, that's the leader. Or maybe there's a person in your family, when they speak, you think, well, they at least think they're in charge. Mm-hmm. But this is a voice that unmistakably, anybody who hears it goes, this person is in control. Or maybe it was the description of what comes out of his mouth, a sharp, double-edged sword. The book of Hebrews picks up on this idea. There's a story in the Old Testament of a judge, a guy who comes with a double-edged sword and uses it to cut out the dung from an evil, wicked king. I'll let you read it later. But it's about the impact of what he says that is so clear and so true and so sharp that nobody goes unaffected by what this heavenly man says. This priestly king who judges. And we could go into every Old Testament reference and sit back and dig into each feature. But I don't think that's what we're supposed to do with this. We're supposed to sit up and look and just go, wow. Wow. Who is this man? One commentator warns us to not try to unweave the rainbow of this picture, but instead to stand back and admire and be struck by this man, this awesome Lord of life, this one who sits in heaven as king over all, who judges every person with his word and his authority, this one who speaks, this priest who represents, and we are simply meant to come to the conclusion that Jesus is not small. But so what? Why is John telling us this? And this is where we need to take a step back and to think about the context into which Jesus is speaking through John. It's the end of the first century, somewhere 80 to 90 to 100 AD. The Roman Emperor Domitian is in power. And Christians throughout the empire are being persecuted. Their worship of God, the God of the Bible, the God who came into this world through the person of his son Jesus, their worship is being considered offensive and unacceptable. Because they will worship only God alone. They won't fit in with the surroundings. They won't go with everybody else to the temple and worship whatever God is in vogue. They won't say all views are equal. They will say, no, we will worship Christ, the one true God, as revealed in his words, and him alone. And whilst maybe the church was small and insignificant, people were happy to let it go by. What happens is that the church then begins to rub up against everybody else. And people begin to reject the church as they rejected Jesus. And so people and the churches were persecuted. This is a struggling, suffering, waiting church. That's how John describes himself, but them too. And so for those Christians and those churches, Rome is might. Rome is power. Rome wins. And then Jesus writes to his churches about not just what they can see, but what they can't. And Jesus, through John, writes to them and says, you must have faith in what is true and to trust in what is true even if it can't be seen. Because they can see the might of Rome. They can see the power of the world. They can see the domination that comes upon them. You must obey. You must submit. And Jesus, through this letter, through this vision, says to them, no, Jesus is might. Jesus is power. Jesus wins. So hold on. So be patient. So endure. So choose goodness and righteousness, even if it's costly, even if it hurts, because what you cannot see with your eyes is what is true in heaven. That Jesus is the great king, not Caesar. That the kingdom of God is the kingdom that ultimately will rule and reign forever. Not Rome, or not the next empire. For the judge of the world stands in heaven, and he is the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Not just in one moment, but forever. This is Jesus who says, I am the living one. I was dead and now look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. Imagine a people who any day could get a knock at the door and they could be dragged away from family, from loved ones, from their jobs, from their very lives to hear Jesus say, I hold the keys to death and life. Not those soldiers who might knock at your door. Not the emperor. I do. Jesus riffs off the name that God spoke to Moses in Exodus 3, the great I am. He says, that is who I am. The unchanging Lord and King of the world. Friends, sometimes our Jesus becomes too small. We have this little Jesus in our house at home. I think it was from the weekend away, given to our kids, and the kids' work, a little Jesus figure. Okay, so it's just sat on our side. And it's great. It was given to our kids to remind them of Jesus. It's a really good thing. But it's just sat there on our island in our kitchen. And it's just been gnawing away in my head as I've thought about this talk and just thought, sometimes, actually, that's what I do to Jesus. My Jesus is really small. Small in my heart. Do I really believe that Jesus is King of the world? Do I really believe that Jesus holds in his hand the entire universe? Small in my time. Yeah, I worship Jesus, but really, am I only giving him one day a week or one afternoon a week? Small in my prayers. Do I really believe that Jesus is there, acting, sovereign over every person and every situation? Or has my Jesus become small? And other things become big, don't they? Other situations, other people. Revelation 1 reminds us that Jesus is not small. He is wonderfully and wondrously big. It's true for us. It was true for those persecuted Christians in Asia Minor 1900 years ago. And it's true for Christians all over the world today. We've prayed for some of them. Annie led us in praying for our brothers and sisters in places where they still face the knock on the door that might mean the end of life as they know it. But Jesus is big. Secondly, it's not a little Jesus. It's not a distant Jesus. So we've seen that Jesus is in heaven, the great King who rules and judges. But what is he doing in John's vision? What does John see? I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me, and when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and among the lampstands was someone like a son of man. Well, John sees these lampstands. And again, with our 21st century heads on, we just go, well, that's just furniture. Maybe slightly strange furniture. But if we put our Old Testament Bible heads on, we think of Zechariah's vision of a solid gold lampstand with seven lamps and the promise that God, by his Spirit, would reestablish his presence amongst his people. Or, more simply, we can go down to verse 19, where Jesus tells us what they are. Write therefore what you have seen, what is now and what will take place later. The mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven golden lampstands is this. The seven stars, the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. So, in this vision, as he sees this glorious king, the king is walking and amongst and near to the churches. Okay, so that's the premise. Why lampstands? Well, it becomes apparent that as we read through our Bibles, that God's people are light, or should be light. The representatives of Jesus in this world, Jesus who says of himself, I am the light of the world, but then also says of the church, you are the light of the world. As we act like Jesus, as we are transformed by the grace of God, as we are molded and shaped into the likeness of Jesus, as we act like him, as we love like him, as we speak of him, we hold out light in a dark world. And so the churches are lampstands, seven of them. Well, as we've read through this, we go, well, that makes sense, because he's writing to seven churches. These seven places that are mentioned, Ephesus, Smyrna, and so on. Seven real historical places, seven real historical churches that were known to John. Seven churches just like us. You know, with all the quirks and normalness of a church. The people who sit in the same seats every week. Really trying not to catch anybody's eyes now. Okay. The people, the same people who come in at the wrong time of the songs. The people who always get to the refreshments first so they get the nice biscuits. Usually they're smaller people. Okay. Normal churches with normal people. And this great, glorious King Jesus is amongst them. All seven of them. But we also want to note, seven in Jewish culture is representative. It's a symbolic number, okay? It means the whole or the fullness or the perfect number. So even as we read these about these seven particular churches, we can also know that God is speaking to us of the whole church and every church. And it shouldn't be a surprise to us that we find Jesus right in the midst of his people. Because that's one of the story arcs of the Bible. That is what God is like. That's what Jesus is like. Jesus who tells his people he is the good shepherd who knows his sheep, who cares for them, who leads them to green pastures and to quiet waters, who protects them from wolves. It shouldn't be a surprise to us that God, the God of Hagar, who saw her at her worst as she fled from her mistress with her illegitimate and rejected son, God saw her and knew her and comforted her. The God who hears the cries of his people in Egypt as they suffered. It shouldn't be a surprise to us that the God who stepped into this world and even before he arrived was named Emmanuel, God with us. In one sense, our expectation of great kings and great people is that they will be nowhere near the commoners, that they live in palaces far away and far removed, only coming out to wave and smile and open things. But when it comes to the God of the universe revealed in his word, we find in him a desire to know and love and be amongst his people. And so when we read that this great Son of Man is amongst the lampstands, we are reminded that God is near to his people. God is near, and yet our circumstances can sometimes make us feel as though God is not near at all. Have you ever thought that? Have you ever thought, where are you, God? This is really hard. We can believe the lie of the great enemy of God's people. That is Satan, as he whispers to us. He whispers in the quietness of our hearts and the deepest parts of our soul. He says, if God was near, then things would be different. Then this wouldn't be happening. God is near. And yet, sometimes in churches like ours, we can be quite content with a distant Jesus. We can be more concerned with knowing the right things and believing the right things and being right in our theology and our doctrine and our practice, but in a sense quite content with Jesus being quite far away. But what we find in Revelation 1, as John sees this vision, is a Jesus who is not distant, but near. Near to his people. And we don't just get it as he walks around these inanimate lampstands. Actually, we see it played out with his interaction with John. As with those before him who have experienced these glorious visions of the Lord, John falls down, having seen Jesus. He falls down as though dead. In light of being in the presence of the judge of the whole earth and the Lord of history, John cannot stand. And we could read back into Isaiah and see how he becomes so aware of his sin. Surely John is feeling that too. So aware of his weakness and his failures. So aware of his mortality, his limitedness. And he's afraid. How can a man or woman stand in the presence of a holy God? But what does Jesus do? This Jesus who is near to his church and amongst his people. He speaks and he comforts. His right hand, which we've just been told is holding stars, I don't even know what that looks like. Can't even get my head around that. But he's got a big enough hand to be holding stars. Places that very same hand onto John. That is a Jesus move. This is the Jesus who touches those who are unclean, who reaches out, who does not consider himself above, who does not fear being made unclean or dirty by others. He reaches out to John and places his hand on him. And he speaks these words, "Do not be afraid." This great God of glory, this great King, this Judge of the worlds, speaks personally, intimately to John. John, who would have had so many reasons to be afraid. Wouldn't we? Wouldn't we be so aware of our words, of our broken commands, of our impure hearts? Because of the half-hearted good deeds that we have done, the secret sins that nobody else knows of, because of our failure, wouldn't we be afraid? But Jesus speaks to John and says, "Do not be afraid." Why? Because I am the living one. I will not fail. I have conquered death. I will see the job through. So God is near to churches and to individuals, to us. And so he spoke to the churches then, and he continues to speak to us, the one who knows us better than we know ourselves. And as he speaks to us, his words coming out of his mouth like a double-edged sword is going to cut us. It's going to reveal us. As God speaks to us, he will commend and convict. God is no flatterer. Jesus does not over-commend or falsely commend. He does not say things are better than they are just to make us love him more. Nor does he say things that are worse than they are just to crush us. Jesus speaks truth so that we might know where we are and so that we might move towards life and towards him and towards health as a church. He's not a little Jesus and he's not a distant Jesus. Jesus is going to speak to us as he spoke to those seven churches over the next 7 weeks. And the question simply for us is this. Having seen who a little of who Jesus is, and what he is like and how he looks towards us. Are we ready to hear him? Let me bring this exhortation to us. Or John is going to do it. Chapter 1, verse 3. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy. And blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it. Because the time is near. REC, are we ready to listen? Are our hearts open? The time is near. One of the great mysteries of Revelation, we don't know when near is. We don't know when these things will come to pass. Only it is time to respond now. And as Jesus speaks to his church, as our sin is revealed, let us be quick to confess it. And as life and growth is shown, let us rejoice. Let us be encouraged. Jesus is not some old school teacher who just wants to beat us with a stick. As we read these letters, we will find great encouragement in those historical churches, some of them, and we will see it in ourselves, I'm sure. We will hear Jesus look and commend us. And we are not to ignore that or to despise that. Because he is the Lord of life who speaks truth. So let us rejoice and give him glory for it. And let us, as over these next 7 weeks, we hear the voice of Jesus, let us glory in Christ, the first and the last. For in him alone is our hope, our life, our joy, our peace, our promise, and our future. Amen.